Over the last week, we've been hearing more and more about H1N1, what most of us have been calling the swine flu. The number of people affected by this virus is on the rise, and yesterday the World Health Organization raised its alert level to phase 5, one step below the pandemic level. Although the largest outbreak has been in Mexico, sickening over 2,500 people, in the United States, we've had over 100 people sickened in 11 states. But despite the media attention, how concerned do we really need to be? Do we all need to run out and get masks, or do we just need to be a little more careful in washing our hands? Well, tonight on Health Matters, we'll try to find the answer to some of those questions, plus your questions at 800-552-8502. I'm Kermit Poling, and I have the great pleasure of being joined by infectious disease physician Dr. Raymond Coughlin. Thanks so much, Dr. Coughlin, for coming on board tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And I imagine, actually, we're not the only ones that are going to be asking questions. I was wondering if, as a physician, if you've been hearing from a lot more people during the last few days.
Oh, many more people. There's a great deal in the media with regard to the swine flu, and there's nothing like a death in an individual to rise, to bring that to everybody's mind even faster and with more intensity, even though that young baby, I guess we'll call him, the 22-month-old that died was Mexican. Mm-hmm. Still, we're wondering how many more people are going to die from this, and it's very difficult question to answer, because we know that it's all like, in all likelihood, there will be more deaths, as there are every year with seasonal flu.
What exactly is H1N1 that separates it or makes it different from, I would say, an ordinary flu virus, whatever that might be?
Well, in fact, ordinary flu virus is an H1N1.
Okay.
The viruses, influenza viruses, are broken down into basically A, B, and C. And A's are generally broken down into an H with a number and an N with a number. B's are not, and C's are not either. A is the more common virus. However, the H is a protein and the N is a protein. H means hemagglutinin. N means neuraminidase. And these are the potent stimulators to the human immune system to react to this virus. Mm-hmm. Those two proteins help the virus gain entrance to the human cell and the human body and start disease. And as we call it, swine flu, also influenza viruses can infect swine populations, bird populations, avian flu. And they have an H and an N, too. Avian flu is H5N1. And, however, that's not transmitted human to human. So the H is a way of denoting or identifying what strain, basically, of influenza that exists. So there are many H1N1s, and one could be a swine flu and the other a non-swine flu.
Okay. The number to call, by the way, with your question this evening is 800-552-8502. Again, I'm joined by infectious disease physician Dr. Raymond Coughlin, and you're listening to Health Matters this evening. And of course, we've been calling it the swine flu, and I know that the pork industry in particular has been a little bit concerned about this, but just for clarity, this isn't something that you can get by eating pork. In other words, it's not transmitted in that way.
Absolutely not. I mean, and that's the industry has already taken a blow because many people aren't well informed with regard to that point. So it's very, very important that it doesn't affect pork in any way whatsoever. It's not transmitted in any way, shape, or form by eating pork. Usually, large swine populations are sick, just like human populations, and they're identified fairly easily. So, and we have not identified a large swine population here, Mexico, or anywhere in the world at this point in time to account for this particular virus. However, it's called swine flu because it's integrated into the swine, porcine or the pig population, and then shuffles the deck of DNA sequences. Now, that use like a deck of cards, if you will, is that you have the same, you have the 52 cards, and that could be the H1N1 virus, and then you shuffle the deck, and you have just this variation in the sequences, which would be the cards, and then it depends how that's dealt as to how, in fact, virulent it might be. Mm-hmm. Certain sequences are more virulent than others, and you can see that each year, sometimes a similar virus, H1N1 virus, infects a population, and 5 of 100,000 die, and another year, 20 of 100,000 die because it's more aggressive.
You know, from what we hear in the media, you know, as this outbreak continues to grow, as it appears to be, you know, makes it sound like the virus is just out there hunting for victims. But from what I recall, and I could be really wrong on this, but it's been a long time since I've been in school. But a virus itself isn't actually alive, or is it considered to be alive on itself, or it actually has to have a host to carry it? Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works. Bacteria really basically lives independently, and viruses need a host to continue. So the most virulent virus will destroy its host quickly, and so the endemic, or the number of people that will be infected, are few, because it kills the host. So a milder virus can do much more damage over a longer period of time.
That makes sense. 800-552-8502 is our number here at Red River Radio. Call tonight with your question, not just about H1N1. If you have other questions about infectious diseases, by all means, go ahead and give a call. The number again, 800-552-8502. Now, the World Health Organization raised their level to Phase 5, which, to my understanding, is the first time in history that they have done that. It sounds like, you know, we're at war or something. There's some sort of nuclear battle going on. We've just raised to Phase 5. But what exactly does that mean?
It really means get your house in order.
Okay.
It means every country in the world, the World Health Organization, is telling every country in the world, get your house in order, that this virus may be present in your country, is likely present in your country, and have all your as I said, your house in order, your ducks in a row, and have all your communication skills and sets in order. I have all the public health system strategies ready to go. It has nothing to do with virulence. And virulence is a word that we use basically when an organism is getting ready to kill something.
Yeah.
So the degree of its ability to kill someone, that's the virulence. So it's got nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that at this time we have limited knowledge, but by the definitions of levels of preparedness, we're at the maximum level prior to major shutdown of communication, not electrical or communication, but of roadway communication. When we had a full pandemic, we have a major problem in the world as far as a full pandemic would mean isolation or quarantine of each country to begin with, and then segments of each country that would have to be limited, and so roadways and things would be closed. But we're certainly not at that point. We're not even close to that point. The alarm is, get ready, be prepared, this could happen.
Okay. We have our first question for the evening here. This is Donna in Center, Texas. Donna, thank you so much for calling this evening. What's your question for Dr. Coughlin?
Yes, I recently was at a school that was closed down due to N1H1 infection. What is the time frame, the window of, well, not opportunity, but do I need to worry about being contaminated? I was at this school Tuesday a week ago. and they were closed today.
The it's the window you did. It depends on which side of the microscope you're on. The window of opportunities for the virus, as you pointed out, and not for the human. But incubation period for the virus is, it can be very short. Is 3 days. It starts. If it takes up residence in you, it starts multiplying in about 3 hours. So it. I would think by this point in time that you would have been symptomatic, and that at this. And I would suggest that you not really worry at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for your question. Again, the number is 800-552-8502 if you have a question this evening for Dr. Coughlin, as we are discussing H1N1, the swine flu here on tonight's Health Matters. Now, you started to talk a little bit about, you just briefly approached into what a pandemic means, the difference between where we are now and what could happen. And I don't want to, get too much into a pandemic situation, but you talked about things that governments will do, like at that point, closing transportation, that type of thing. And I know it's very hard to gauge, but the last pandemic that we really have had anywhere was back in the early 20th century. Is that right? So it's been a long time. It's not anything that we've had more recently.
Well, we've had a number of pandemics in as late as 1968. We've had a pandemic. A pandemic doesn't mean the whole world shuts down. It just means the number of countries that are involved, and the definition means that an easier spread of, in this case, a virus.
Mm-hmm.
It means that the population at large hasn't been exposed to this particular sequence of proteins in this virus, and so it's much easier for it to infect humans.
Gotcha.
We use endemic, epidemic, and pandemic. And endemic means it occurs just within your region, and it's a very small number of people. Which means that, in one sense, that if you've been exposed to this virus, you're less likely to be infected. So, therefore, we have fewer numbers. So, mm-hmm. If you've been immunized, you've gotten the flu shot the year before, and it's similar virus this year, then there are going to be fewer people, even though you got the shot last year, who will be infected. And if they are infected, it's usually a much milder case. To that point, we've already decided, but it's been decided what makes up the vaccine for this coming flu season beginning in October. So, and it's very similar to the vaccine of last year. So if that's true and the virus that comes into town, we should be immunized, we should be protected, to a better degree than we are without it.
Right. We have another caller. This is Phil in Shreveport. Phil, thanks for calling this evening. What's your question?
Yes, good evening. Just driving on the way home, and I work at an area hotel. What mm-hmm. should our hotel management be doing to, housekeeping staff and stuff like, what should be doing special or doing more prep work right now just to kind of ease the peers of, or our guests and other customers that, are visiting our area? Is there something we should try to be doing different?
I don't think it's something, it's a great question. And I don't think it's something we should be doing differently, that you should be doing differently as in the hotelier business. But we should be a heightened level of alertness. So if you see somebody or walking by, and Kermit mentioned this early, you cover your mouth when you cough, you cover your mouth when you sneeze, you perhaps dispose of those tissues, and you're aware that maybe some of the people staying in your hotel have the tissues are now a little more infected, and so you handle those a little more carefully. That doesn't mean you have to wear a mask, because I don't believe the housekeeping staff generally wear masks when they're cleaning. But those things. And the other thing is, in a gentle way, is to remind the consumer that, you know, you didn't cover your mouth. We have to be responsible enough to stand up in front of one another and say, there's a problem out there. Most people are aware there's a problem. So when it's brought to their attention, they usually say, oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I guess that answers a lot of good questions that's been going through some of our minds. Is, you know, hotels maybe on a little different, or just kind of keep it good practices that we've been trying to do all along.
Exactly. Well, thanks, Phil. Thanks for your question. There was another person that he didn't want to go on the air, but we have his question written in here. It's a listener that says he and his wife will be vacationing soon to Mexico, going to the Sea of Cortez, and they want to know if it would be better for them to take Tamiflu before they go as a preventive measure or lessen its severity if they get it. And I'll ask also, I suppose, for your opinion as to, because there are, of course, travel advisories about going to Mexico at this point. Should they consider canceling the trip?
At this point, the advisory states, unless you must go, don't go. So if this is just a lie in the sun sort of vacation, then I might reconsider going at this point in time. The other part of your question, Tamiflu, or also Tamivir is the generic name of the drug, is not basically used for that. If you're going into an area wherever you're staying and you know you're walking into influenza, there's a group of people around you who will have influenza, then there may be a point to taking oseltamivir or Tamiflu. But generally speaking, I wouldn't use it that way at all. I wouldn't advise you to use it that way as a protective mechanism.
Is there a disadvantage to using it? I mean, is there a negative?
Negative in the long run is that all our organisms learn how to be resistant. And to that point, this year, you were far better off in the seasonal flu, the H1N1 that was here locally, and in the country, 99% of it was resistant to Tamiflu. And yet you were better off to be immunized, and we still have a problem getting people immunized. So it's going to be a combination of things when you're trying to defend yourself against the influenza virus.
1-800-552-8502, the number here to call in with your question tonight about H1N1, the swine flu, as most of us call it. 800-552-8502. I'm Kermit Poling. I'm joined by Dr. Raymond Coughlin, and we're discussing, of course, the flu on Health Matters this evening. Another written question, and this one I think is one that's probably close to impossible to answer. Any clue as to how long the duration of the pandemic will be? That makes the assumption that it will turn into a pandemic, of course. But we're talking about pandemic situations in the past. How long did those last? I mean, what's the usual passage of time for something like this to?
Well, if we look at looking at seasonal flu, it was late this year. It peaked the end of February, the beginning of March, and it starts in October. So usually that period of time, if the virus is of the same virulence, we'll say, then it should end over a four-month period. However, you can do a lot of damage in
four months.
I mean, 1918, there were the estimate, and it's an underestimate, of 50 million deaths in 1918. So most of that was with secondary infections. When you get a viral respiratory infection, then you injure your lung, and then you can have invasion with bacteria a little more easier. And many, many people died of streptococcal pneumonia in 1918.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call with your question this evening. We have Jan in Shreveport. What's your question for Dr. Coughlin?
I've got a 3- and 5-year-old. The 5-year-old had the flu this year in town, but neither one had been had received vaccinations. And I'm just wondering, is it prudent, or would it make sense to have either one of them get the vaccine at this point?
That's an excellent question. We all often use vaccines in different ways in medicines. In medicine, sometimes to abrogate or change an outbreak. Considering that we've just said that the seasonal influenza here is just passed, then it probably would not behoove you to have your children immunized at this point. And when children are immunized, the different age group, you said 2 to 5, we immunize children now over the age of 6 months. And so there's a recent suggestion that we should immunize all children over 6 months, not only those with chronic diseases.
You had mentioned earlier that, we grow, or the viruses grow more resistant. And I know that there are people that prefer not to get immunized against the flu. Is generally, in your opinion, though, it is a better solution or a better idea to go ahead and get the immunization rather than wait it out? Or is it better in the long run to if you're healthy and not to get the shot?
Well, if you think of the basis of immunization, the reason that we were immunized for smallpox is because it was such a horrendous disease.
Mm-hmm.
A great example in the children population, the pediatrics, was the tremendous burden of a bacteria called Haemophilus influenzae. And we saw much meningitis and much disease, respiratory disease, with that organism. It almost disappeared with immunization. We rarely ever see Haemophilus influenzae meningitis because of immunization. We're immunizing babies at birth with hepatitis B vaccine. And so the answer to your question is, in my opinion, is that if we have a vaccine that's useful, and they usually don't reach the market unless they're very useful, we should immunize ourselves and take every opportunity to get that.
Okay, 1-800-552-8502, of course, is our number here at Red River Radio. You can call in tonight with your question for Dr. Coughlin. And we do have Pat in Brooklyn, Texas, who's waiting. Pat, good evening to you. What's your question?
Hi, I have a daughter that lives in South Texas and teaches at a high school there. And the high school has been closed because they have a student that's been identified to have the virus. She has 2 young children, an infant and a 7-year-old. And she doesn't know whether to keep the 7-year-old home from school or what should she do to protect her children. And she doesn't know if she's been exposed directly because they won't reveal the name of the student who is involved.
There are many questions there. Thank you for some of them and bringing them up. This is an age of transparency, and it's very difficult to, I think, probably for fear of, more than anything else, that the child's name hasn't been released. However, in a good public health system, that you want all your contacts notified of exposure. So, with regard to your 7-year-old, I guess the question of the obvious point was it doesn't go to your 7-year-old doesn't go to your school, which you're teaching, because it's still open. Unless that school has a problem, I don't see any reason to keep your 7-year-old at home.
Okay.
When did that school close?
Today. They got an email from the superintendent last night that the school would be closed indefinitely.
Right. So you, at this point, don't know that you've been exposed or not, and don't know whether, in fact, you're going to have the flu. Well, it's very difficult, but unless you became symptomatic, I would number one, again, I wouldn't take any drugs. And if you became symptomatic, this virus is susceptible to oseltamivir or Tamiflu, so that's available. And only then, well, the difficult part is by then you have already exposed your infants and your children. So it does make it very awkward, but I would, again, send the seven-year-old to school, and then the rest is just careful observation. I don't think immunizing the child or yourself for taking a drug at this time, you know, that doesn't leave too many options other than waiting.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Pat. 1-800-552-8502 to call in with your question. Here's another written question. And, of course, this particular virus has been reported now in 11 countries. The question is it normal for this type of strain to appear simultaneously in different regions around the world?
It would be very unusual to have a sequence of proteins in a single virus develop simultaneously in various countries of the world. It's usually spread somehow, so there's human motion that's occurred from one to bring that into the country from another country in some way or other.
Well, we're just in a world that we can transport ourselves from one end of the world to the other very quickly.
Right.
And my understanding, of course, you know, a lot of what we've heard seems to make this sound like it's originated in Mexico. But now the belief is, I think that they've traced it. They think that this was brought into Mexico from, I forget where I read it on, maybe it was the CDC site or something like that. But it's been transported, and then that's
right.
How it's making its way around.
Right. And so it may appear simultaneous, and yet if you track it, then you'll find that there's been, as I said, people have moved from one country to another and brought it with them.
Sure.
And we have no evidence that we have large swine populations that have moved from one country to another to infect the country.
1-800-552-8502. Joe in Longview, thank you so much for holding tonight. And what's your question?
Yes, doctor. I am a recoverer from Guillain-Barré syndrome of about 20 years ago. I was hospitalized, ran pretty much the whole gamut of symptoms up to bipolar paralysis and up to the point of they said the next thing to do is die after that, but then I started getting better. I was told at that time that I should never again get a flu shot. Can you comment on that? And I'll take that answer off the air.
Thank you.
People are advised not to have influenza immunization after they have had Guillain-Barré with that history. If we go back to 1976, swine flu, and there was a swine flu immunization, and there were a larger than usual number of people that got Guillain-Barré, and it was.
And let me just ask you, what is Guillain-Barré? Okay.
Guillain-Barré syndrome is a nerve disease that is called. Another name is ascending paralysis, where it doesn't always ascend, but generally speaking, originally when it was described, started at your feet and worked up towards your head and gradually paralyzed you as it went. And in some people it stopped at their ankles, and other people it stopped at their neck, and they needed to be intubated, put on a respirator. But that particular syndrome can happen with many viruses. It's not particular to influenza. And the point originally, it was thought that there was a relationship with the vaccine. But in further study, it appears that it had little to do with the vaccine. But it does create a fear. And at this point in time, if you've had it once, if you've had Guillain-Barré syndrome, that's the reason that we advise people not to be immunized. So you're absolutely correct and a very good point.
What about people with other conditions, and not just about whether or not they should get immunized, but you know, who are the people that need to be more cautious? And what I'm thinking of are coming to mind, maybe cancer patients or diabetics. I mean, what's the situation for them? Should they get immunized? Do they need to be more careful than the general population?
There's no question that that people with any kind of chronic disease, not respiratory disease, people with kidney disease, people on dialysis, people who live in nursing homes, people over the age of 65, and there are many people under the age of 65 living in nursing homes, anybody that is at risk, people with chronic heart disease, should be immunized every year. There's CDC recommendation. There's a list that is put out every year of who should be immunized. And in every hospital now, we monitor every admission to ensure that at least the question is asked, have you been immunized? Do you want to be immunized? Specifically during the flu season. One of the things that's changed in our world is with the travel. When is flu season? Mm-hmm. Flu season is really 12 months of the year. It's just shifted now and ended here, but beginning in the Southern Hemisphere. So if we travel to the Southern Hemisphere and we stay there for any length of time, we're in flu season once again.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call right now for health matters as we're discussing the swine flu, H1N1. Dr. Raymond Coughlin, infectious disease physician, joining me right now for this edition. And we still, we're more than halfway through the show, still time to get your call in. Again, the number 800-552-8502. So we're talking, and we touched on this a little bit earlier. You mentioned some ways, and I think this was related to the hotel question, about protecting oneself or protecting others. What do we really need to do? What are the best ways that we can help to assure that the flu isn't transmitted or that we don't get it?
Well, on a personal basis, I said if you have a cough or sneeze, you cover your mouth. You wash your hands no matter what you do. With the number of, if there are increasing numbers of individuals with flu in your area, you stay away from crowds. You stay out of crowded places. Parts of the world, there are restaurants, well, Mexico, there being restaurants closed. Public areas where you gather are being closed down. And so you would avoid crowds, basically. It means your big shopping centers. And so that's how you do protect yourself. And so the alertness here is important. And how many cases are there around? Well, we don't know. It's an underestimate no matter what number we come up with. Mm-hmm. But if somebody says we have 1,000 cases in Shreveport and Bossier City, then at that point you wouldn't go to the malls and the schools would be closed and we wouldn't go there. So, but on a personal basis, and there's a recent publication where compared and using the flu prior to the swine flu even being mentioned, of washing your hands with soap and water versus the alcohol-based gels or other alcohol-based products. And it turned out that statistically it was, first of all, most important, and both were good with in reducing disease, influenza disease. But soap and water was better than alcohol-based product. So if you don't have to go out and buy alcohol-based products. Now, I think on the national news that somebody mentioned Purell, which is a product, an alcohol-based product. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about those products is you can put them in your pocket. It's just you can put a bar of soap in your pocket, but
you might not have access
to water.
Right.
So those products have been very good in that way.
So it's better. It's not as good as washing with soap and water, but it's better than doing nothing.
Correct. Absolutely. Oh, much better. It's very close to, I mean, there's not that much difference between the two of them.
Okay. But, and what about the wipes, as long as we're on the subject? You know, we just get the wipe out of a, it already has it.
If it's alcohol-based, the wipes, the baby wipes, they don't have to have bleach in them. The alcohol-based, but we've got many more products with bleach in them, with obviously lesser amounts than we have in a gallon of Clorox, but those are not necessarily better than alcohol-based wipes.
Gotcha. 800-552-8502. We do have a couple people holding. Thank you for so much for being patient. I think we have, this must be Anonymous from Longview. Okay, Anonymous, what's your question this evening?
Hi, I am an employee at a disposed due to the virus, and I have a question.
Could you repeat that? Because you kind of cut out there for a minute. You're an employee where? I'm sorry?
I'm an employee at a district that closed due to the virus.
Gotcha, okay.
And we closed so that we wouldn't continue to spread the virus. So rather than go out and be around people, I would, you know, not knowing whether we could be transporting the virus, I was wanting to get tested to see if I could be spreading it in the 48 hours that I could be incubating it. But I'm having a hard time finding anywhere to get tested because it seems that everyone is run out. Is there anything else I could do or just wait it out before I can be around friends and family?
You say you've run out. Are you mean you've run the area's run out of testing kits because
of? Yes, our county has run out of testing kits for this virus, and they said they don't even know where to get anymore.
Okay, I have. Each county will have testing kits, and if there's a larger number of people who are exposed or possibly exposed, then should be able to import those through a separate county public health system, even a different state. And then there's the federal government that should be able to assist with kits as well, since this is a level 5, and you're out before a pandemic even exists, and please God it won't exist, but at this point, if you don't have access to a kit and you're asymptomatic, then the only thing you can do is wait. But you won't have to wait long. And the other thing is, it's not a quiet virus. It's when it gives you influenza, it's not a runny nose and a sore throat that might last 3 or 4 days. Usually, you may get a runny nose, sore throat, fever, all in short order. The severe aches and pains and muscle aches and pains strikes quite hard. It's many people say, well, I had the flu, and they've had a gastrointestinal disease, a gut disease with diarrhea and nausea and vomiting. Well, that's not the flu. The flu is a respiratory disease, affects your nose, your sinuses, and your lungs. But to your point, again, I mean, if you can't get a kit, you either drive to a place that has a kit, since your locale isn't able to bring them to you, and then you're going, well, that's the whole point. I'm supposed to stay out of crowds.
That's a good point.
Then,
yeah.
But you know, since you can also, you can phone a separate county's health department and they may mail you one.
All right, we have another caller here. This it must be someone on their cell phone. This is Caroline in North Texas on the way to New Orleans. And Caroline, what's your question this evening?
Hi, yes, I'm on my way to Jazz Fest. And as you probably know, they expect about 400,000 people there. And the question is both clinical and economic. Should we even go? And what is the danger so significant that we should take the economic hit at this point, or do we just go on and just keep
keep lathering ourselves up with Purell and so forth.
Well, I don't, first of all, I would go. It's difficult to miss Jazz Fest. You can say, well, the argument there is contrary to what several things we've said, is that you try and avoid crowds. And here you have, you know, a crowd of at least 100,000 people you're about to get into. But at this point in time, we don't have evidence that large numbers of people with the influenza in that area. And so without that, you could say, well, there's... we shouldn't go to Dublin because we're going to have to go into several airports. And if travel is limited to some degree, but, you know, without large populations of known infected individuals, I think I would, go ahead and enjoy myself.
Worth it for the music. Are there any indications that this particular flu has come to Louisiana? Have you heard anything about it or no?
No. Yes, I have. And no, we haven't had
So
any
it's
cases
not...
that we've recognized. But again, I mean, they're here. And there's going to be H1N1 seasonal that's in one or two individuals. It's a bit late and somebody's going to, but we won't know it's swine.
We won't know it's one or the other, right?
Until it's sent to the public health department.
1-800-552-8502. The number to call for your question for Dr. Coughlin this evening as we are discussing the swine flu or H1N1. This is Steve on Interstate 20. Good evening, Steve. What's your question?
Good evening. Thanks for listening. To address a previous caller, what I wanted to know if she could get tested to see if she had it. I know in Louisiana they've got guidelines as far as being able to submit specimens to the lab, which turn would want to be forwarded to the CDC. And if the patients don't meet certain clinical and epidemiology guidelines, you can't even submit that specimen. So they're using the physicians more as a clearinghouse on a local level to keep patients from just flooding them over. Now, on another thought, too, the rapid tests that people are familiar with for the flu test, those, as of right now, have not been proven that they will detect this swine with H1N1. Now, they can detect the type B flu, and physicians are recommending or have been recommended that if the patient tests positive for type B, end of story, they don't have the swine flu.
And a comment?
The nasopharyngeal swabs, the swab that goes into your nose and reaches back down towards your throat, there are different kits. There are A and B kits, and there are B kits. And you can get a rapid test that will tell you that you've had influenza A. And most of the A's are H1N1 here this season, but there's others that are H3N2, right, that different sequence. But at the same time, your comment is very well taken, that if you suspect that you have disease, then your physician decides whether you should be tested. Otherwise, you're absolutely correct. We could have thousands of people wanting to be tested without good rationale and without, as you pointed out, the clinical indication to do so.
Right. Can you add to, as far as the development of the vaccine, which will come, but it'll take several months, would they, should they, and are they probably going to incorporate into next fall's cocktail for the immunization?
Next fall's cocktail, as you called it, has exactly the same H1N1 component as this year's did. The A components, which are made up, the vaccine is made up of three components, usually two influenza A viruses and a B virus. And the only component that's going to change for the upcoming 2009-2010 is the B component.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call with your question this evening. We are about, we have just about 11, 12 minutes left for tonight's program. So if you've been waiting with a question, by all means, get it in. 1-800-552-8502. And we do have a caller that's in there. I don't have your name yet, so I'm just gonna tell our engineer, Rick, to go ahead and bring them up. So caller, whatever your question is this evening, thanks for joining us. And what's your question?
My name is Carol.
Okay, Carol. I got it now. It came up. Carol on I-49. All right. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, fine. Thank you. We're on our way to Florida, and we're scheduled to go on a cruise to the Bahamas. And we are wondering if we should wear masks and or gloves on our cruise.
Excellent question. There's, even though we suggest people who are in large groups where there is the virus, or where we believe the virus exists, at least small numbers underestimate the large numbers that are really there, then we suggest that you wear a mask. However, unless there's a change, and there's a change from hour to hour here. Unless there's a change, your trip should be free of virus. I mean, if you look at statistics, free of serious infections with the virus. Unless we see an outbreak in the Bahamas, you know, that would ruin your trip. But I would take the masks with you.
1-800-552-8502, the number to call. We've had a lot of great questions this evening. 1-800-552-8502. Here's another call. This is Dan in Shreveport. Dan, what's your question?
My question is, don't you agree that it is a poor use of antibiotics to add them to animal feed in the name of giving a few extra pounds to animals, but with the drawback or the penalty of making these antibiotics useless for humans?
There is no argument with what you just said. The use of antimicrobials worldwide is under great scrutiny. Not just in we talk about doctors perhaps utilizing antibiotics, and I'm saying antibacterial agents, We do see evolution of resistance because of agricultural use of antimicrobials, but there are large societies of veterinary medicine and human medicine that are working hard to try to create antimicrobial stewardship and trying to improve that through education and limiting its use, not just in four-legged, as you probably know. Fish farms are also loaded with tetracyclines and things to prevent the ick and improve the outcome of, in volume of the species. So it was it's a very good question. Hard to get a handle on in developing countries, antimicrobials, as you know, can be gotten at your local store, certain countries, you can drive down or walk down the street, and if you think you've got a serious infection, you can get intravenous antibiotics. So there's abuse of antimicrobials that continue, and it's a huge problem to get our hands around in both human and agricultural and in husbandry. But the Infectious Disease Society of America, CDC, everybody is very aware and is working hard to try and control that somehow.
You're listening to Health Matters this evening. I'm joined by infectious disease physician Dr. Raymond Coughlin, and we're talking, of course, about the swine flu, H1N1, and other infectious diseases. If you have any questions, give us a call at 1-800-552-8502. Too much longer left in the show, so if you do have a question, by all means, give us a call sooner than later, 800-552-8502. One question that was written in, and I think this was relating to something that you had mentioned earlier, or perhaps about the caller wondering about the availability of the tests. How prepared do you believe we are in this country if it is a pandemic situation? Tough question, I know.
You're as prepared locally as anywhere, in the sense that all pandemics, all all terroristic approaches are defined at home. They're not there's an outline for what we should do by the federal government, by CDC, which is part of the federal government, as to what we should do. We have supplies that we can access from the federal government of drugs and investigational tools, but it's what we do at home that's the most important thing, and we are very well prepared. There is, we have had the advantage, if you will, of Katrina and other storms that have led us to better preparedness and a better communication from north to south. Better communication in our public health systems, better communication in our emergency systems than many. We had the opportunity to direct NIH and when Katrina was here, and help them decide how to manage emergency and what emergency measures need to be taken. But because of our previous experiences with other terroristic approaches, we are much, much better prepared. And then we have an advantage of our neighbor to the north, who had a great experience, or depends how you look at it, with SARS, and how we control it, the use of masks, how we isolate people. We have that advantage. So we are better prepared than we have ever been prepared. We're not perfect. We're far from perfect. And there's, you know, you hate to be tested with a pandemic, but, you know, you find out your flaws at that point in time when you're under duress and how you deal with things. But structurally, we are very sound in this state and I would say in this country.
1-800-552-8502. Getting very close, actually, to the end of this program. Just so, a couple questions, just from me, and with the understanding, of course, that you are Shreveport-based and most familiar with this area. If people want additional information, what are some good choices, good options to find out more?
Well, I can give you a number of the Hospital Emergencies Operations Center, national, from the Department of Health and Hospitals, which is 1-877-611-6883. You can look in the, I believe, blue pages of the telephone book for your public health, for the parish, which will direct you to the region. It's structured. We have regions, healthcare regions in the state of Louisiana. I'm not going to list those numbers, but they are readily available. And then there's the website, the www.cdc swine flu website is just an excellent source of information at this point in time. And in fact, there's another if you look up Time Magazine daily news on the web, that's another excellent source.
Okay. We do have, I think this will probably be our last caller for the evening. This is Travis in Center, Texas. Good evening to you, Travis. And what's your question?
I was just wondering if, with all these certain diseases like the bird flu, and now we got the swine flu and stuff like that, is there any way that we can eradicate these things? You know, I mean, is it, Is it something that's stockpiled somewhere and it just slips out, or is it something that we can eradicate, like, what was it, smallpox or something like that, that they, you know, thought they got rid of and then it started to make a comeback or something like that? Is there a way to get rid of these things for good, or is that just beyond our capabilities?
That is an absolutely great question. The problem with viruses is they mutate. They change frequently. We've been talking earlier about sequences of how many ways can you arrange one card in a 52 deck. If you shuffle it 10 times, you'll have 10 different arrangements. And the permutations and combinations of that are great. And that's what happens with the virus. And so we can't have one vaccine forever. There are multiple A viruses, multiple B viruses. And so at this point in time, we couldn't possibly eradicate influenza. We have to come up with other means. At this point, the best we have is being immunized. And that, we recognize the most frequent virus happening at a time, and that's how we develop what vaccine we're going to use for the next flu season. The most likely virus is not perfect. Even the vaccine itself is not perfect. However, we have at times missed it. 3 years ago, the vaccine wasn't as good as we thought because the virus mutated in a different way. The combination of proteins in human virus, swine virus, and avian virus are also changing when you integrate those three viruses, and the fear of the avian virus becoming human to human contact, it depends on new sequencing, and that's we seem to be waiting for the appropriate sequence for a horrible event. But we're not close, but it could happen very quickly. I mean, mutations are not predictable.
Well, Dr. Coughlin, I want to thank you again for being with us tonight. It seems like the best protection that we have are all the good things that our mother taught us to do, to wash our hands frequently.
Absolutely.
And cover our mouth when we sneeze.
Absolutely. And don't be afraid to wash your hands. If you think of it, wash them.
I'm Kermit Poling, and joining me this evening has been infectious disease physician Dr. Raymond Coughlin on this edition of Health Matters. As always, this program is for general information only. If you have a medical condition or have questions about symptoms, you should always consult with your physician. Tonight's program was produced by Renee Moran with assistance from Wally Derleth and Robert Murphy. It was engineered by Rick Shelton. I'm Kermit Poling. Thanks again for joining us this evening. Fresh air coming up here in just a moment. You are listening to member-supported Red River Radio, a public radio service of LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches. We also stream online at redriverradio.org. Have a great evening.